We are talking today with Dr. Helen Caldicott. Dr. Helen Caldicott is a Nobel Peace Prize nominee and the founding president of Physicians for Social Responsibility, where she served in that position from 1977 to 1986. In addition to founding PSR, she is also the founding president of the STAR, standing for Truth About Radiation Foundation, founder of the Women's Action for Nuclear Disarmament, and founder of the Nuclear Policy Research Institute. Her articles have been published in numerous publications, and she is the author of 7 books, including Nuclear Madness, What You Can Do, Missile Envy, The Arms Race and Nuclear War, If You Love This Planet, A Plan to Heal the Earth, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer, and she is here to talk about her new book, of which she is the editor, Crisis Without End, The Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Catastrophe. Dr. Caldicott, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us today. So to start out, tell us, what was your motivation in creating Crisis Without End?
I was appalled at the ignorance of the media reporting the Fukushima disaster, and it's ongoing. And they didn't seem to understand genetics or radiation biology or epidemiology or anything about radiation. So I thought, well, I'll hold a big symposium at the New York Academy of Medicine with the very best scientists in the world, oceanographers, evolution biologists, physicians, epidemiologists, and try and attract the media so we can educate them a bit. Well, you know, the New York Times didn't turn up. Matt Wald, who writes the nuclear articles, he was at something else, I think more a pro-nuclear conference. But it was broadcast around the world to, I think, 3,600 outlets. And out of it has come a book of the proceedings, which is really the first scientific analysis of what has been going on at Fukushima. Mind you, it's a year old now, but nothing has really changed. It's just getting worse.
For those that can't remember exactly, can you refresh people's memories on what happened on March 11th?
Well, there was a terrible earthquake in the Pacific near the east coast of Japan. It was a 9, and that's very big. And after followed a tsunami, because the earth moved and the ocean moved up, and it was a very tall tsunami, 45 feet high, and it rushed in. And if you can remember the photographs of ships and people and cars and houses being swept far inland, and many, many people died. The Fukushima Daiichi plant was built at sea level. Actually, they excavated a cliff to make it build the plant lower at sea level. And the seawall they had was, I don't know, 12 feet high or something. And the tsunami totally flooded the Fukushima Daiichi plant. There were 6 reactors. 2 were not functioning, 3 were, and 1 was being reloaded. Now, to keep a nuclear power plant running with 100 tons of fission and uranium in its core, you have to keep it cool consistently because enormous heat is produced, which, of course, is turned to steam, which turns a turbine, which generates electricity. So all a nuclear power plant does, essentially, is boil water. And as Einstein said, nuclear power's a hell of a way to boil water, and that's putting it mildly. So what happened was nuclear power plants must have external electricity supply to power the pumps to circulate the water at 1 million gallons a minute through the core. And, of course, with the earthquake, tremendous damage was done and the external power supply was lost. However, they had a whole lot of huge diesel generators in the basement, the size of a house, which were powered, programmed to start immediately. The external power disappeared, but the tsunami flooded them. And so they were inoperative. And therefore, there was no cooling water. Therefore, within hours, three nuclear power plants started to melt down. And the 3 of them melted down within about 3 days. However, the Japanese government didn't tell anyone for 3 months. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission here in Washington was having conniptions. And if you read the transcripts of their discussions, I mean, they were terrified. Naoto Kan, who is the Prime Minister, who I now know at the time, was so alarmed that he was talking about having to evacuate Tokyo, 35 million people. It was just serendipity that it occurred on Friday afternoon and not at night, because there are over 1,000 people operating the Daiichi plant, and just down the coast is the Daini plant with 4 more nuclear power plants, and that was in trouble too. So they had their full staff. Had it been at night, probably they all would have melted down and Japan would have gone. As David Suzuki in Japan, in Canada, said, it would be bye-bye Japan. And it still could be bye-bye Japan because it's a very earthquake-prone area. Some of the buildings are extremely fragile. There were 4 huge explosions, one of which was a nuclear explosion. They call it an excursion, but it was nuclear. And especially Building 3 is very fragile. It's still got a huge cooling pool on its roof, protected by nothing. The molten core has melted its way down onto the concrete of the containment vessel, but maybe into the earth. And if that collapsed, there would be a nuclear inferno. Building 4 is also similarly fragile, and it's got a huge cooling pool on top with all its fuel rods, but they have been removing them. And it's been a very delicate procedure, and they've removed almost all. So if that collapsed now, I think it would probably be okay. Meanwhile, there's a range of mountains to the west of the reactors, just close. And so mountain water pours down continuously beneath the reactors, and when they were intact, that was fine. But now, with 3 molten cores containing the most ghastly, deadly radioactive elements like plutonium, americium, cesium, strontium, tellurium, you name it, is exposed to this water washing over it continuously, and the water is extremely radioactive. Meanwhile, they're having to pour seawater continuously into these 3 cores to keep them cool, and as it recirculates back, it's terribly radioactive too. So they're sucking out that particular water and putting it in huge tanks, about, 1,500 tanks, 3 stories high, held together with sort of plastic and corroding bolts and stuff. And those tanks contain, 360,000 tons or gallons, I can't remember the number, of extremely radioactive water. So if there's another earthquake, those tanks will collapse and all the water will pour into the Pacific. Meanwhile, the water submerging underneath the reactors coming from the mountains is pouring to the Pacific continuously. 300 to 400 tons per day have been pouring into the Pacific every day for 3.5 years since the accident. And so a lot of people say, well, it will become diluted. The Pacific's a huge body of water. However, the solution to pollution by dilution is fallacious when it comes to radiation because there's biomagnification in the food chain. So, for instance, cesium concentrates hundreds, thousands of times in the algae. The crustaceans eat the algae. It's concentrated by orders of magnitude in the crustaceans. Little fish, big fish, and then us. And fish swim thousands of miles. Of course, they swim anywhere they want. And so on the coast of California, about it, a year or two ago, they were catching tuna containing cesium from Fukushima. But it will get worse. And there's no end in sight. Nuclear engineers have no idea how to get to these radioactive cores. They're so radioactive that people would die if they got near them because the radiation is so intense. And, being a physician prognosticating as I do with patients, prognosticating on this disaster, I don't think they'll ever remediate it, and it will continue, and the Pacific will get more and more radioactive. And, I live on the Pacific in a little fishing village in Australia, and we could easily be eating radioactive fish in a year or 2 or 3, and you can't taste radiation in your fish. You say, this tastes nice, this whiting, this tuna, but you can't taste, smell, or see radioactive elements. And once they get into your body and deposit in various organs and concentrate in various organs, it takes 2 to 80 years to develop cancer. And that's the incubation time for cancer. So it's cryptogenic, silent. It's a silent killer, radiation. Whereas, if I cough on you, within 2 days you're coughing, you've got my flu or my cold. So that's the ace up the sleeve of the nuclear industry, because it's so invisible. And when cancers occur, you then have to do epidemiological studies to secure the fact that, in fact, in this population, cancer has increased enormously, like they've done with Hiroshima and Nagasaki and lots of other situations.
So 300 to 400 tons of radioactive water per day. And I believe TEPCO's rosy prediction for when they're going to get things contained is 40 years out. But the rest of the experts don't seem to back that up.
Oh, Michio Kaku and, you know, the real physicists who know what's going on say there's real no real solution. Arne Gundersen, who actually worked for the nuclear industry for about 30 years as an engineer, he can't really see any solution at all. I mean, none of this is in their textbooks. And that's the thing with nuclear power. You know, Chernobyl happened, and don't forget that's in the Ukraine. And don't forget Russia and America are confronting each other in the Ukraine. Ukraine is still very radioactive. They've had a huge numbers of cancers and leukemias and the like. There are 15 reactors in the Ukraine still. You can't have a war, conventional war, in a country with nuclear power plants because they could well melt down. It's easy to melt down a reactor. As well as that, America and Russia still have their weapons on a very high state of nuclear alert. Well, it seems that they do. And, you know, this situation in the Ukraine could precipitate a nuclear war. But to get back to my main point, a stupid man in the middle of the night did a stupid experiment with Chernobyl, which was only operating for 3 months. And the thing exploded, burnt, and melted down. And one stupid man with a nuclear reactor contaminated a continent, the whole of Europe and Britain. There are still farms in Wales and Britain with lambs that are so radioactive they can't be sold on the market. There are wild boars running around Germany, so radioactive they almost glow in the dark and have to be buried in radioactive waste facilities. I mean, because what happens is as the cattle, the boar, the lambs eat the grass, the radiation, of course, has concentrated in the grass and concentrates further in their flesh. And so it does in human flesh. And so, therefore, the cancers will go on for not just this generation, because cesium lasts for 300 to 600 years, plutonium lasts for 250,000 years, and these isotopes are very long-lived, and they will be contaminating the food in Europe for virtually the rest of time in our time frame. Turkey was so radioactive. They were so annoyed with the Russians. They picked all their radioactive tea and sent it to Russia for the Russians to have. But I don't eat any Turkish food. And don't eat Turkish apricots. Don't eat Turkish hazelnuts. Most of the hazelnuts that we get now that flavour our coffee and the like come from Turkey. So you have to be well educated about these situations. And that's why this book, Crisis Without End, is going to be published, and why I wrote my book, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer, because it explains the medical ramifications of all things nuclear.
It appears so far that both the Japanese government, TEPCO, and the rest of the world are not really taking this very seriously, and the solutions that they've come up with so far, like the ice wall, are a joke. I mean, people were mocking that when it was first put out there, and it has since been proven that it's not working at all.
Well, the water is probably fairly warm because it's washing over molten, very hot radioactive cores. One. Two, to make an ice wall, you refrigerate the ground and turn it into frozen ground, but you have to have huge amounts of electricity to do that. And, you know, you'd have to have it operating for 100 years without failure. I mean, yes, it's a joke. Arne Gundersen thought that if they built a sort of barrier of zeolite, which actually absorbs cesium, on the mountain side of the reactors, way above the reactors, which blocked the downfall of the water from the mountain, and then have pipes to divert the water, clean water, into the Pacific, that could be one helpful solution, but no one's taken that seriously. The Japanese government is very sort of claustrophobic. The Japanese are funny people. I've been there 3 times in the last year, and they're very hierarchical. And TEPCO really is the Japanese government. They call it the nuclear village. And so the Japanese government, particularly the new Prime Minister Abe, is very, very pro-nuclear. And he wants to also rearm Japan, which is very scary because we were nearly invaded by the Japanese in the Second World War in Australia. And so they take no advice from anyone else. And, you know, they could easily ask Bechtel, which I don't like Bechtel because they build nuclear power plants and George Shultz was their president, but they know a lot. And if they were invited into Japan to help try and formulate a solution or some solution, that would help. But the Japanese are very proud. And TEPCO is covering up. And they use workers or they subcontract to get their workers. And one of their main subcontractors is the Yakuza, which is the Japanese mafia. Apparently, for years and years, the nuclear industry in Japan have been working closely with Yakuza. And so they are getting people, homeless people off the streets in Tokyo and elsewhere, mentally retarded people, alcoholics, and bringing them in to help remediate the situation. And these people are getting very high doses, some of them, of radiation. They're not being adequately followed up. They are unskilled. They're running out of warm bodies to continue to, well, not operate, but to remediate the situation. And I said it's going to go on for a long, long time. And there is now a law that's just been passed in Japan to say that reporters who report on this could be jailed for 10 years. So there's a huge cover-up, not just in Japan, but, may I say, in the United States of America. And Obama is a nuclear president. He got $250,000 from Exelon to be elected. Rahm Emanuel worked for Exelon. So did, I can't remember the other fellow that worked with him. And so he's pro-nuclear. Hillary Clinton signed a deal with Japan just after the accident to say that you would continue importing Japanese food. A lot of the Japanese food is very radioactive. I went to a sushi bar in New York fairly recently, and it was, you know, they're glamorous and people are drinking their sakes and eating their fish. And I said, where does the fish come from? They said, Japan. So I got my sushi, which was sourced from New Zealand and from Canada. Don't eat Japanese food. Don't eat Japanese rice, fish, miso, seaweed, anything, because you don't know where it comes from, but much of Fukushima Prefecture is really radioactive. And there, they, apart from the water washing into the ocean every day, 300 to 400 tons, they're now asking the fishermen if they can just, instead of putting it in these tanks, this other water, if they'll just tip it into the ocean. And I mean, it's a disaster beyond compare. It's not the end of the earth or anything like that. But it means two things. One, if there's another major earthquake, it could be a disaster for Japan and the northern hemisphere. And two, it's an ongoing disaster, and there will be hundreds of thousands of cases of cancer and leukemia and babies born deformed and genetic diseases down the time track, as we've seen in Chernobyl, where a very important report which summarized the papers of 5,000 Russian articles and translated them into English, shows that now over 1 million people have died as a result of Chernobyl. That's 26 years ago, I think. So you extrapolate that to Japan. Yeah, they were lucky. The first 2 days, the winds blew across the Pacific and huge amounts of radiation went east over to the east coast. I may say that the ambient levels in Seattle of radiation went up 40,000 times above normal in those first few days. So you got a fair bit of fallout and radiation. And then the winds changed and blew over Japan. They didn't tell the people where the radiation was going, and the people fled into the path of the highest radiation levels. They didn't want to create panic, so they kept the people ignorant. And, of course, Japan is very heavily populated, unlike, you know, the Ukraine and the Soviet Union and the like, Belarus. And so you could extrapolate to a degree the Hiroshima the Chernobyl data to the Fukushima situation.
And even here in the U.S., since the accident, there's really no testing program for the fish or the air or the water or anything.
Well, it's unbelievable that you're not monitoring the air, the EPA. I think in various places they are, but on the whole, it's not being done. The water is being monitored by private groups sometimes. The fish is being tested by some private groups too. But because there could be another accident any time, it's imperative that your air all down the West Coast and indeed across America, because americium was found in Boston, you know, be monitored on a daily basis, and the water in the Pacific and the fish, and posted so that the public can watch the data and see and analyze it.
The U.S. has what is now considered a failed system, but has been pouring millions of dollars into, for instance, a bioterrorism detectors across the U.S. You know, I think in this state there is at least a couple dozen of these detectors. Yeah, we can pour money into that failed system.
How do you detect terrorism? What about bio-detectors?
It was for sniffing, let's say, anthrax or the different,
God,
you know.
Almighty. That's called paranoia, just simply paranoia. And it's a great way to divert people's attention from the real dangers. Like, we could have a nuclear war tonight, I kid you not, over the Ukraine. We have come very close to nuclear war on numerous occasions in the past. I'll give you one example. America was going to launch a weather satellite from Norway. And America's got 14 Trident submarines. On each submarine are 24 missiles. On each missile are 8 hydrogen bombs. And they circulate silently through the seas at all times. And when this missile went up, the Russians thought, oh, God, a Trident has launched its missile, and you've got a policy for a first-strike winnable nuclear war, which means, how do you win a nuclear war? You decapitate Moscow. Notice the terminology you use. You kill Putin so he can't press his button. You launch all your missiles, 2 on each of their missile silos, 2 hydrogen bombs on each missile silo, to kill their missiles. People dying, that's called collateral damage. And because the Russians are very worried about being decapitated, they've built a huge cave in the Ural Mountains with one single missile called the Dead Hand. If Moscow is decapitated, they send up the Dead Hand, which sends a signal, radio signal, down to all their missiles to be launched without any human input. So the Russians thought, my God, maybe this is a decapitating strike. Now, the Pentagon had alerted the Kremlin about this missile being launched, but the Kremlin lost the data. Human fallibility? That's how a nuclear war could easily start. They picked up this missile, and there's Yeltsin sitting there, and they opened the football for the first time. Do you know what the football is? The football is a suitcase with nuclear codes that follows Yeltsin and Obama around at all times. And if you watch Obama, there's always a man with a suitcase following him, so he can annihilate the planet. When Reagan was shot, they lost the suitcase for 2 days. And so they opened the suitcase for the first time ever in Russia, and there's Yeltsin, a hardened alcoholic, like a bottle of vodka before breakfast sort of thing. Wernicke's encephalopathy, Korsakoff syndrome that you get from alcoholism, his general standing over his shoulder. He had 3 minutes to decide whether or not to destroy life on Earth. And they were saying, press the button, Mr. President. Here's the missile, you know, coming towards Moscow. 3 seconds before that 3 minutes elapsed, the missile veered off course. That's how we're still here. I got to know Robert McNamara really well. We used to have lunch in Washington, etc., when I went down there. And he said to me, he was in the Oval Office during a Cuban Missile Crisis. He said, Helen, you don't know how close we came to within minutes. Now, with the state of heightened anxiety, as is being set up by the neocons in the State Department, I have to say, they set up the whole Ukrainian situation. I think Putin's been really restrained. So we've got heightened anxiety, human fallibility, computer error, and the computers make mistakes. Hackers into the into the Pentagon, 1,000 a day. On 9/11, STRATCOM, Strategic Air Command, got to the highest state of nuclear alert, DEFCON 5, 4, 3, 2. And one is press the button, simply because no one knew what was happening and it was just total anxiety. So you see, all those factors together could easily destroy life on Earth. Why do I say that? Because there are at least 40 hydrogen bombs targeted on New York as I speak, 60 on Washington, 60 on Moscow. Every town here, the population of 50,000, is probably targeted with at least one H-bomb, and the Russian bombs are big. All your universities and colleges, your industries are all targeted. I mean, here's Seattle with Amazon and Boeing. Goodbye. You're a huge... And as all the cities burn and the oil refineries burn, huge clouds of toxic black radioactive smoke rise into the stratosphere all over the Earth, covering the Earth with a cloud so thick it blocks out the sun for up to 10 years, and there will be incurred a short ice age, and everyone and everything will freeze to death in the dark, apart from the fact that people are vaporized, burnt, turned into missiles, huge firestorms engulfing the cities, ozone depletion, so you'd get sunburn in 5 minutes, and all the food's radioactive. I mean, that's what we're facing. So who are the real terrorists? How dare they talk about terrorists now? And you know, America killed, with the coalition of the willing, including Australia, about a million people in Iraq, half of whom were children from the sanctions, etc. And so three people get beheaded. Dreadful. Dreadful. But where's the common sense and the humanity and the understanding and the statesmanship or stateswomanship? I can see none. What would FDR have done? What would JFK have done? I don't... Why do these people still think they can kill? And the latest, you know, inventions in science always go towards killing people. So my next book is going to be called Why Men Kill and Why Women Let Them, unless we diagnose this urge to kill in the reptilian midbrain of many men, not all men. I know most men wouldn't want to kill, but some really do, and the psychopathy behind it. Unless we diagnose the cause or the etiology of this pathology infecting the human race, we'll destroy ourselves. And I once asked Carl Sagan, who was quite a friend of mine, I said, Carl, do you think there's any other life in the universe? And he paused for a long time. And then he said, no. And I said, why? And he said, because if there was any life and they'd evolved to our state, they would have destroyed themselves.
You were talking about Seattle as a target. We're 20 miles from the Trident Banger nuclear subbase where we're sitting at.
I know. We've got the Trident base here. I mean, it's like I fly into Seattle and I pass Boeing, miles and miles and miles of Boeing. They are one of the major contractors making weapons, weaponizing space and missiles, etc. That Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, all of them. They're masters of death, annihilation. I mean, it's beyond my comprehension as a physician who spent my life trying to save lives and helping people and extremists to die, you know. I can't understand. And when I looked at those pictures of Gaza and the men holding up their babies in beautiful dresses with no heads, or a child with its brain blown out, I mean, going into the autopsy room when I was a medical student was bad enough, seeing a beautiful, beautiful body like a David lying there of a young man with not a mark on his body who'd been in a motorbike accident and severed his brainstem, or a woman lying there with lactating breasts who had breast cancer that had gone rampant as she'd had a baby and died. Right? Those sort of things. What we don't get in the Hollywood films and all this ghastly killing stuff is seeing the results, the human consequences of what we're doing. I don't know.
Well, with that, We are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending
time
with
Mike.
Us.
Thank you.
Again, we've just been talking with Dr. Helen Caldicott. She is editor of the new book, Crisis Without End, The Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Catastrophe. And in addition to her book, you can find out more via her website, helencaldicott.com.